This episode of the Deck Tease Podcast is brought to you by Grand Prix Portland. Join Cascade Games and Channel Fireball on August 7th through the 10th for the Team Sealed main event, with $63,000 in prizes, as well as side events firing all 4 days and panels featuring your favorite Magic personalities. Go to gppdx.com for more information. Welcome to episode 94 of the Deck Tease Podcast. I am your host, Erin Campbell. It's just you and me this week, folks. I know many of you were looking forward to hearing DJ Spruik come on this week and talk about himself and his work, but he got sick and had to cancel. So that put me in an interesting position of having to come up with another guest on short notice. I had a few invites pending, but nothing really confirmed. I had some guests lined up for the next few weeks that were set in stone, but nothing this week. So I took to Twitter, and one of my followers, a gentleman named Jason Sweat, hello Jason, suggested that I do a greatest hit show. He said that he just discovered the show, he liked what he heard, but he really hadn't had a chance to go that far back and hear everything that I've done. I ran the idea past my boss, Mr. Staborski, and he was down. So I spent a few hours listening to some past shows and finding 10 clips that I liked the most. And here they are in no particular order. First up, a conversation that I had with John Dale Beattie that is to date the only time on my show that I've ever said the word coochie. This episode made me laugh so much because John Dale still says that his mother has not listened to this episode, which made me feel that we were doing something right. Now, I do want to possibly put Wizards under the interrogation light here. I have heard rumors to the effect that Wizards tends to be a little funny about people and artistic freedom. Specifically, there's somebody from Legit MTG who I really enjoy. I believe they go by the name Polish Tamales. And I'm under the impression that they've been getting a lot of criticism from Wizards about what they can draw and what they can't draw. And I've heard that from other artists as well, or people who enjoy the art side of things. And I would equate that to more Vorthos behavior. What do you think about that, John, when you do see Wizards sort of putting their foot down like that? Do you feel that that's hurting the Vorthos community, or can you understand why Wizards is being kind of firm about that?
Are you trying to get me in trouble or merely succeeding?
Well, no, but it does seem like, I mean, we did talk about how Wizards is encouraging you guys to do your thing and have your conversations. But at the same time, there is an element there of, well, if you're enjoying these things and you're not meaning any harm, why can't we draw them? And why can't we do these fictional, you know, portraits of people and things like that? It does seem almost like a Wizards giveth and Wizards taketh away.
Well, on the one hand, happy customers do buy more, mm-hmm. and the more you're involved in these communities, probably the more products you're going to buy. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, there's this tacit approval. If you don't go too crazy, then go for it. But for example, I'll go first fan artist, Polish Tamales. Polish Tamales has done some rather infamous art. For example, the Christmas time Liliana, mm-hmm. With her in a suggestive pose and a gagged and bound Jace in her Santa Claus sack behind her, which on the one hand is very funny, but on the other hand, if I were in Wizards Corporate, I would not want my prized planeswalker depicted that way. And then Steve Argyle. For my money, Steve Argyle is he comes across as a serious horn dog, mm-hmm. and that's the nicest way I'm going to put this because my mother might listen to this. And on the one hand, he does some awesome art, but on the other hand, his unauthorized depiction of Liliana and Chandra in a rather suggestive pose, where when Wizards saw that, they basically said, no, and you're not going to do this again if you're going to keep working for us. Again, it's Wizards' intellectual property. Don't abuse it. On the one hand, if you're being creative and you're coming up with these ideas, if you're not abusing it and you're just participating in the fan culture, then as far as I know, Wizards doesn't have any problem with that, because that fan culture and that fan community is why Magic is one of the best-selling brands at Hasbro. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they do have to defend their intellectual property, at least to a certain extent, because if they don't, then it gets genericized. They lose it. They lose control over the message they want to send. And they've come down where they're saying things like, Jay stuffed in Santa Liliana's sack and Liliana and Chandra tangled up together. That's a no-go. And as far as I'm concerned, it's like, okay, Wizards has laid down those lines. If I were an artist, I'd respect those lines. I'm not about to write any Liliana and Chandra sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G fanfic. So it's like, Wizards has those lines. I'd rather not approach those lines, and I definitely don't want to cross those lines. So I see both sides of the argument, and I do tend to agree more with Wizards' approach of, these are our characters. We leave you a certain amount of leeway just because we do like our fan creations, but please, let's just keep it sane.
No, it's interesting because, like, I was looking at the pictures while you were talking. I Googled them, and maybe it's just me, but I don't see the big deal. Like, I did see the Christmas one, and I think it's kind of cartoony and kind of fun. And from what I can see, it looks like Lily's on some sort of couch. I don't really see a sack there, no pun intended. She seems to be moderately clothed. There's a little bit of boobie. But I mean, I see thigh high leggings with bows on them, which I'll admit I've got a pair similar to that. And we've got a sexy Santa outfit. I'm not seeing any nipple. I'm not seeing any coochie. I'm not seeing any booty. And she seems to
My
be
mother
on this.
Is so not listening to this now.
I'm using like soft terms. I'm not saying like titties or anything, but, and she appears to be on this, like, it looks like maybe like a beanbag chair or a variation of that. And you do see a man who I didn't even know that was Jay's, cause I could have sworn Jace was blonde, but so there's a man, you see a bandana maybe around his mouth. You don't see his body, you don't see him in anything, you just see kind of his head popping up from behind the beanbag chair, and I think it looks kind of harmless. I mean, maybe it's just me, but I think it's well done. I think it's silly. I don't think it's meant to be erotic or overly so, and I admit with this I don't see the big deal.
Well, that's just one example of Polish Tamale's work.
Oh, I know, but what I'm saying, especially,
I haven't seen the entirety of the oeuvre, but
especially if you compare what Liliana's wearing on her card, you're seeing about the same level of boobie, and you're seeing about the same level of thigh. It's just a different costume, so it does seem a little hypocritical to me that this would attract so much ire, but yet when we show boobie and when we show thigh, we being Wizards, it's okay. But when you do it, it's too much and it's wrong. And
sometimes the pros who write for websites will do these mailbag type shows where people can submit their questions and they will answer them. But the questions are usually pretty simple. You see the same ones over and over again. And I like to do the exact opposite of that. For example, when I asked Brian Kibler what it's like being a sex symbol and what it's like to date him.
So in addition to being a Magic player, a game designer, you also occupy a very unusual place in the community, Brian Kibler, and I've been dying to ask you about this. I don't know if you know this or not, but you're also known as being a bit of a sex symbol. Women love you. Some of the men love you. You have to know this. You have to see some of the tweets people fling at you. Some of them from my horny friends, which I'm embarrassed about. I think one of my friends sent you a tweet one time, and she was like, we should all gather all the panties Brian Kibler has ruined and send them to him. And
I saw that one. I was mortified
because I'm pretty ballsy. Like, I'm pretty bawdy, and I can hang with the best of them. And Lord knows I've said some terrible things about you. And it was funny because I had just sent you, like, the questions, and I was like, he hasn't agreed to come on the show yet. Oh, my God. And I was ready to die. And how do you feel about that? Are you comfortable with that? Does it weird you out a little bit? Like, what do you think about that?
I mean, the whole notion of being of me being famous is sort of weird to me, let alone, like, you know, being some sort of sex symbol to people. I read this article not that long ago. It was an interview with Matt Damon where he was talking about how, you know, fame is such a weird thing because, you know, one day you're sort of, you know, a bunch of people know who you are, who didn't know who you were the day before, and you're still the same person, you know, like you nothing really changed in your life in sort of a tremendously appreciable way, but people look at you very differently. Mm-hmm. And that's really weird. It's sort of, it's a very surreal sort of experience, to, you know, have people sort of interacting with me in the way that they do sometimes at Magic tournaments, to respond to meeting me the way they do. You know, there've been people who are, you know, so excited to, you know, meet me or have me sign something for them in an event. And I mean, it's awesome. It's really cool. It's pretty amazing that, you know, like that I can have that sort of, you know, impact on people, you know, just for playing cards or, you know, whatever it is that I do. But it's still really strange. And the whole, you know, sort of being, you know, sex symbol or whatever in Magic is particularly bizarre because, you know, well, I grew up, you know, I grew up a fat kid, you know, like I grew up like, you know, like the sort of.
Wait a minute. Is that you in your Twitter picture?
Oh, yes, it is.
No.
Yes, absolutely. That's that picture that I put up like in the past, you know, week or so on Twitter and Facebook. That's me at like 13.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you never lose that, because actually I dated somebody who was a former fat kid, and he was – it was weird to me because, you know, I found him kind of adorable with the extra pounds, I'm not going to lie. And granted, he had looked much better now, but I would have taken him back then too with his personality. And it was very interesting because no matter how much I complimented him – and it was never a problem. Like, it wasn't that he was insecure, but, you know, one of the things he always stressed to me was you never stop being the fat kid on the playground. And
it really is true. Like I was actually having this conversation with my girlfriend over the weekend, and you know I was sort of explaining to her that, you know, that if you're someone who you know grew up with, you know, some sort of like body image, you know, issues or whatever, that like it's not something that just like leaves you, like if you're, you know, you were like in shape later or whatever, or that you have the sort of latent, you know, sort of insecurity that came from being picked on when you were in grade school or like, you know, by your older brother or whatever, that is, you know, still sort of, you know, an ingrained part of who you are. And you know, it's funny, like I remember like, you know, when I was in high school, and you know, when I was like my senior of high school, you know, I had been like wrestling for 2 years. I was in like ridiculous shape at that point.
Were you wearing the little onesie outfit with the cup?
I was wearing singlets, not like all the time.
Okay. But... that would have been awesome personally. Yeah,
but, but my brother came to visit me, and, you know, like he, cause you know, I was at boarding school. Mm-hmm. And you know, he was like, you know, hanging out with me and like my girlfriend at the time. And you know, my brother, like when we were kids, you know, we were as brothers were sort of, you know, we fought a lot, you know, we picked on each other for various things. You know, he always picked on me for sort of being, you know, this, you know, awkward fat kid. And you know, I was like, you know, in ridiculous shape with a really hot girlfriend, like, you know, doing, you know, super well in school and like, you know, was on like varsity sports team. He was like, what the hell happened to you? He was like, when did you become like super jock stud boy? Like, I don't understand. But I mean, you know, it was just very, very much the sort of like turnaround in my life. And I actually think that wrestling was, you know, something that had a huge impact on sort of my, my sort of perspective of myself moving forward, because it was, you know, not only doing something that was like extremely challenging for me, you know, just as a person in general, like, I mean, wrestling is incredibly hard, but it was doing something that was so far outside my comfort zone. Like, you know, I grew up the nerdy fat kid who is like, you know, always super good at like, you know, games in school, but like, you know, never played any sports, whatever. And then just went from that to like, you know, being on my varsity wrestling team and like winning medals for my school, like, you know, my senior year. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but even then, like, you know, I still had the same sort of latent insecurities that came with that. So
I can relate to that for sure. Like, I grew up being different. I'm transgendered, and I grew up in high school not really knowing what I was or who I was. And I was on a show the other day called Delving in the Draft, which is a great podcast I love with a couple Scottish guys. And my show has really taken off recently. I just got picked up by Legit MTG. Medina personally recruited me for his website, which was huge. They've really done a good job of supporting me and promoting me, and the caliber of my guests is really really improved. And I had Adam Staborski the other day be like, I want to be on your show. And I'm like, oh my God. And one of the guys on Delving Into Drafted asked me, he's like, you know, you've really turned into this tour de force lately and people know who you are and people are dying to be on your show. What is it like? And I can kind of relate to that in that, you know, having a successful show and having people want to be on your show is acceptance. And there's been points in my life where being different, I've never had that. And it's always been one of those things that I've wanted really badly, but I've never known what to do with myself when I have it. So when I see the head of Gathering Magic volunteer to be on my show, it blows me away. It's just like, I don't know what to do with myself. It's like, you know, I've always wanted to fit in and I do feel like I fit in this community. But at the same time, there's that part of me that's like, this can't be real. This can't be happening. What do they want with me? Why do they like me? And I get it. I get not being able to leave that kid behind sometimes.
So. Very Freudian.
Yeah. Maybe I got deep there, but. So you've also mentioned throughout the show, and you've been very open about the fact that you do have a long-term relationship. And it's funny because I can't help but think about what those conversations were like, you know, when you're getting to know somebody and you're ironing out your terms, as I call it, because I always look at relationships sort of like a contract. And I'm just trying to imagine how that conversation goes down where she's like, so what do you do for a living? And you're like, well, you know, I play Magic and I design games. And oh, yeah, I'm going to be gone this weekend, that weekend. That one's not going to work either. How does that work? Like, how does someone date you? How does that work?
Well, it's kind of funny because I actually the first time I actually met Natalie, my girlfriend, was actually at Grand Prix Anaheim. She didn't play Magic then.
Okay.
But we actually had been, you know, had met sort of over OkCupid, the online dating thing.
Brian Kibler used OkCupid.
It's true. Yeah.
Wow. See, I do too. See the choice of Brian. Are you just saying that because they offered Magic cards for like a subscription?
No, not at all.
I didn't know if they had you on their payroll. Like, OkCupid worked for
me. But no, it's a free site. Like, it's not like they're buying me off or anything.
Oh, I know. I just remember they made that tweet the other day where they accidentally said you could trade like Magic cards for like.
There was the whole thing with Finkel on OkCupid or whatever.
Oh my God, that was
pretty
crazy.
Hilarious. But yeah, so we had sort of been chatting back and forth, and she was like, let's hang out like here. I'm like, nope, I can't. I'm out of town. I'm at this tournament. Nope, I can't. Out of town. Nope, I can't. And, I was like, yeah, I'm playing this tournament in Anaheim because she lived in Orange County at the time. Mm-hmm. And she's like, great, I'll come by there. So, my first sort of, interaction with her was, she showed up. Thankfully, it was a tournament where, I had just made top eight when she got there. I'd actually just drawn into top eight.
That would have been mortifying.
Which was particularly amusing over the course of our relationship, because for a while she had a very skewed view of what like a reasonable performance to expect was. Because mm-hmm. the first tournament she showed up, I was in top eight. And I was like, oh, great. And at one point she was saying, she's like, oh, you really haven't been doing well lately. And this was a point when I was in a stretch of Grand Prix finishes that was probably just like better than anyone else in the world. Mm-hmm. I had made top 16, top 16, top 16, top 32, top 16, with that top eight before. And she's like, yeah, you haven't made top eight in a while. It's like, but I've finished top 16 in everything. Come on.
Go sleep on the couch.
but yeah, it's your question before about, the whole sex symbol thing or whatever is kind of funny because, she was very aware of, the fact that I get, propositioned on Twitter or have people following me on Facebook or whatever. She has, people subscribe to her on Facebook now because she's my girlfriend.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah. She'll show me her phone and she'll be like, do you know who this person is? And I'm like, nope. She's like, okay, that's weird. But yeah, it definitely, the whole traveling thing, certainly was difficult at the beginning of our relationship because it didn't even happen for a while because we couldn't meet. but the fact that I've been home for the past month and a half and we've actually spent a ton of time together because I have, has been nice. But there's certainly been periods when, it's like, yeah, I'm gone every weekend for the next month and a half. Mm-hmm. Frankly, my reluctance to travel as much as I have over the past year, is certainly informed by the fact that, when I'm gone, she doesn't like it and neither do I, for extended periods of time. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a weird sort of thing being in a relationship when you're sort of a public individual. Mm-hmm. I actually changed the settings of my Facebook page at one point when, people were making, I posted a picture when we were at a pre-release.
I remember that.
Yeah, and there are people making, a bunch of just very rude and inappropriate comments. And she wasn't bothered by them. But I was just like, no, this isn't okay. You know, it's not, this isn't like, you know, something that I want to have, like, you know, just constantly going on in my life, where, like, you know, people are, like, you know, gawking at my girlfriend publicly. Like, that's just not cool.
Right.
And, you know, it's definitely a weird sort of thing. She actually, you know, for a while was just like, I'm going to make sure to, you know, like, post pictures of us, like, tagged together on Facebook all the time, so all your groupies know that, you know, you're mine. And, you know, she makes a point to do that every now and then to ensure that I'm claimed appropriately. But
when Ruben Bressler came on the show, he had a lot going on. He was a commentator for Star City Games. He was pursuing a career in stand-up comedy, and he was traveling a lot. I wondered how he managed to keep a relationship going despite all of that. Before Ruben told me his secret, he told me how he and his girlfriend met, and I couldn't have made this up if I tried.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you, Ruben, and I tend to ask this with certain people because I'm always curious how they're able to balance everything. So you're a commentator, you're a comedian. I'm assuming you're traveling a lot with Star City, and yet you're in a long-term relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You love your girlfriend a lot. You talk about her
do.
Often. How do you keep it all going? What's your secret?
Well, the first secret, and well, first of all, let me, if you don't know, my girlfriend lives in Phoenix, Arizona.
I didn't know that.
And I live in Roanoke, Virginia.
So how do you really make it work then?
Yeah, those are far away from each other.
Mm.
And yeah, it looks a little difficult from the outside. Luckily, the girl that I'm dating, the woman that I'm dating, named Sarah, we love each other very much and are also very realistic individuals.
Uh-huh.
So we both know that we both want careers. And we both know that the place to get there, those careers, are where we currently are.
Can I ask how you met her?
Yes, absolutely. I actually wrote a very long Facebook post about this on her birthday earlier this month. We're basically characters in a John Hughes movie. So what happened was I met her at a Halloween party. At Ohio University. So, by the way, this story has a title. This story is called Where's Your Boomhauer?
Okay.
We'll get there, don't worry. I went to Ohio University for school, and OU is known for their huge Halloween block parties.
Mm-hmm.
I like to dress up for Halloween, and one year I convinced three of my friends to go as the cast of King of the Hill. One of my friends was Hank. One of my friends was Bill. I was Dale. And another guy named Joe, who we were friends with, but not as, like, not really close, like me and Mike and Corey were, went as Boomhauer.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a huge block party. Like 20,000 people are probably more than that. Actually, the size of the city is like 10,000 people. That triples when school goes in session. That triples again when Halloween happens. So there's like 100,000 people in the city at this point, in the city designed to hold like 10,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we lose Joe at one point because we're all drunk and, you know, fucking around and doing whatever. And we end up at one of my other friends' houses, who's actually top eight at a couple of Open Series events. Terrell Boaz, if you ever see him in the commentary,
mm-hmm.
he's always wearing the I'm Sexy and I Know It t-shirt in the coverage because he always wears those to Magic tournaments for some reason. Anyway, we go to his house. I walk in and the first person that I see is Sarah. And she's dressed as Alex from A Clockwork Orange.
I've never seen that movie.
Well, A Clockwork Orange is not what you'd expect a sexy woman to be dressed as for Halloween.
Okay.
Let's say. This Kubrick movie is not what you'd anticipate a beautiful woman dressing as.
Okay.
But as a book nerd and as a, you know, someone, as a movie nerd, I was immediately in love and also terrified. and I didn't approach her at all. Right. So until a group, including my friend Mike, went to some back room to get away from the loud music. And I walk into the back room and the first words she says to me are, "Where's your Boomhauer?" She didn't go to Ohio University. She was there visiting a friend, but whatever. Anyway, so we sit there and we talk for a little bit. The group, I still don't have the balls to ask for her number. After the party, I get her number from a friend of hers who, for some reason, didn't think that I was a serial killer. Luckily I texted her. I was able to text her and said, "Hey, I didn't have the guts to talk to you at the party, but, I like you." And she was like, "Oh, same." I was like, "Oh, that's nice." And so we texted for a while And then she stopped responding to my texts one day.
Ugh.
And I thought I'd screwed something up. But as I mentioned in my note, I noted that I am optimistic, persistent, and foolish. So every few months, I just message her, see what was going on, and didn't really – I mean, every once in a while, she'd be like, I'm good, you know, kind of thing like that. But mostly, it didn't last at all. But I just kept doing it. Then, you know, I would get in other relationships and those would end. And the first place that I'd go was to her Facebook message thing and say, hey, what's up? Then last October, I messaged her when I noticed on her Facebook wall that she was going to graduate in the spring from Arizona State with her degree in education. And I was like, oh, that's wonderful. She's put her life back together, because I don't want to get huge into why she wasn't responding to me. Mm-hmm. Suffice it to say, it wasn't my fault and that she needed to get other things happening.
Sure.
So she had to put her life back together. And I was like, I'm very happy that you got getting your life underway. I'm sorry things never worked out between us. Expecting to never get a response. And she responded. So, you know, I'm sorry too. What are you up to? I was amazed and happy. And we talked for hours that first time. And I was like, hey, I'm so lucky on this message already. Why not try the following? Mm-hmm. Hey, so you're in Phoenix. I'm going to be in Las Vegas for the Invitational. Like for the week in between the Invitational and the Open Series in Las Vegas. Yeah, I know we don't really know each other at all, and you're 6 hours away, and you have no reason to come visit me, this guy that you don't really know, 6 hours away in a hotel where no one else will be. But if you want to,
that's not creepy at all.
Yeah, that's not creepy at all. She's never going to say yes to this. Like, we may as well try. Mm-hmm. So for some reason, she says yes. And it was just the happiest moment of my life. And she drives up to Las Vegas, and I rent a room at the Hooters Hotel and Casino because the rate was insane. Like, the deal we got was unbelievable, and I'd heard from lots of other people that it was like a really good hotel.
Oh.
And it actually was fine. Like, I would suggest it again to other people. Like, it was completely fine. It was just a normal casino.
You know, when I think, like, romance, I think Hooters Casino. Like, just,
you know, I'm on a budget, man. So anyway, can we get past that part?
We can get past the Hooters.
I shouldn't have told you. So anyway, so the first time I see Sarah in 4 years is when I look through the peephole of my hotel room. Mm-hmm. I open the door. I say hi. She says hi, and then we kissed for like 15 minutes. It was a John Hughes movie, like, honestly.
Aww.
Yeah. And so now we're 9 months into our relationship, and we have jobs far away, but you know, we're making it work. Mm-hmm. She is a very smart, very driven, very funny, very beautiful individual that for some reason likes me back. And I am extremely lucky that that we're being able to make it work.
Yeah.
But and so I think that the main reason why we are able to make it work is because we don't ask too much of each other, I think. We talk constantly just because we want to. There's neither of us is asking the other one to talk more or less.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of long-distance relationships fail because the expectation of visiting more often or talking more often is there. I was in a previous long-distance relationship that was not three time zones away. It was across the state. And so there was an expectation that it was like, hey, that's only a four-hour drive. You should drive up to see me more often. Or that she should drive to see me more often.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of began a divide that grew and grew.
Right.
I go out and see as much as I can. You know, I want to see her as often as I can. Mm-hmm. So every time that I'm in, you know, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Diego, Albuquerque, whenever I'm anywhere nearby, I make an effort to go see her. And you know, we're going to make it work. And hopefully she says she's likely going to start applying for jobs in the Roanoke area.
I was just about to ask that, like, if she would be required to come to you, or if you could do what you do without being based in Roanoke.
I really don't think so.
Okay.
I've thought about it, but a lot of my responsibilities require me to be in the office.
Okay.
Like even for this thing where I was away for the invitational, I was out of the office for 3 days for travel, and I'm really needed in the office to help out with a lot of things.
Sure.
Based on how my job has grown. Mm-hmm. So it would be possible, but not as likely.
Right.
Because the likelihood of finding a teaching job in Roanoke is much higher than me finding a Star City job in Arizona.
That's true.
So, you know, we've talked about it. We'll figure something out. And if it requires me to move out there, then I'm all for it. And we will have to figure that out when we get there.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, we are very happy.
Well, you sound like you've got a good attitude about it. You know, I've done the long distance thing before. My last relationship was actually in Chicago, which is only a state away. Some people feel that's long distance. Some people don't. But, you know, you definitely touched on some really – I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
So we were about an hour and a half away. Right. And I definitely feel like – I think you touched on a lot of really good points. The main one being is you have to be cut out for long distance. I really feel like part of the reason my relationship didn't work is because my ex-boyfriend went into it going, I can totally do long distance. I'm fine not seeing you totally fine. And then come to find out it's, well, why aren't I seeing you this weekend? Like you said, whereas I'm comfortable with space. I don't need to see my boyfriend
sure.
every single day.
Yeah, I think that we are also very similar like that. Like we can go, we're currently going months without seeing each other, which is tough.
Yeah.
It's not fun. But we'll survive.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's important that that person can handle long distance. Like, I think it's something people find kind of romantic in a way. Like, maybe they've seen too much Sleepless in Seattle or whatever. And they're like, oh, you know, there's going to be somebody out there for me and, you know, all that stuff. And then when it gets down to the nitty gritty, they're not cut out for it. And I think that, you know, that's something I'm inclined to say right now I would never do long distance again, but if I did, I would really need to know that they can hack it too, because it's something not everybody is meant for. And it's always interesting for me when I hear people say that long distance is harder than normal relationships. Like, I feel like they're not. I just feel like there's more of an emphasis on communication. Like, I think communication is a lot like listening, where everybody assumes they can listen and that they are listening, but, you know, they're not always hearing you or they're not hearing you well. And I think that's the same with communication. Where people are like, of course I can communicate. What are you talking about? And it's like, you know, yeah, but when all you have is the phone and all you have is Skype, you really need to know how to communicate. And if you can't, the relationship doesn't stand a chance. So that's why I think it puts people off, because they're really forced to communicate. And it
I'm sorry,
really...
I stopped listening. No, I'm kidding. yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
I am not a big phone person. Mm-hmm. Like, I hate using the actual phone feature on my telephone. But yeah, I completely agree. Like, being able to communicate effectively is a big part of why we're able to make it work.
Well, I hope you can. It sounds like you have a good thing. And I definitely love seeing the happy couple. Like, I love, you know, when you tweet about her and whatnot, that definitely makes me smile. As cynical as I can be and as catty as I can be sometimes, I do like the idea of love. And I like seeing people who are truly in love be in love. And I think that's a great thing. I love seeing the next generation of Magic the Gathering players, kids who've either discovered the game on their own or who have parents who played or parents who still play. Mr. Scotty Mack from the A-Team came on my show and told me about how Magic has affected his family, and it was pretty extraordinary. One of the articles I really enjoyed reading about you actually was on Legit. Heather did a profile about you. I think it was called Summon Legendary.
Yep.
And it was a whole bio about you. I got to see your daughter that we talked about earlier. And something in the article really struck me about you. You were talking about your family, and you had made a comment that in terms of Magic, family comes first for you. If you didn't have the family you have now, and if you weren't so family-oriented, how do you think you would look at Magic differently?
Well, it's funny. I don't know if I'd still be playing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really funny. It's a funny question, actually. So I played back in Revised.
Mm-hmm.
And I played fairly regularly through Revised until Tempest.
I loved Tempest. It was one of my favorite sets of
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, Tempest was just coming out, and that was when we were getting out. A bunch of people that we were playing with all were leaving for university, and you know, it was just time to kind of move along. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we had done our first couple PTQs and that sort of thing. And I mean, my brother top eighted or was on the bubble, I guess, nine for that. It was like back in the day. God, I played a Morrowgeddon deck at that PTQ. And my brother played a modified Necropotence deck that revolved around skulking creatures and Tombstone Stairwell with Soul Shriek. Let me tell you, like, it was spicy.
Your brother sounds like my kind of guy.
he's a lot of people's kind of guy. You know what I'm saying? I'm the one you take home to Mother and Mary. He's the one you take home at the end of the night at the bar. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Uh-huh.
I'll be IMing you my phone number. Keep going.
Sure. Yeah, he just got married, actually. Congratulations. Sorry.
Damn.
I know, all the good ones get snapped up so quick.
Right?
Anyway, so bottom line is I got out of the game, and I kind of only really coasted back in and back out casually. Like, I'd buy a starter here or there. You know, or like the pre-constructed decks that buy a couple just in case we wanted to battle with friends or whatever. Like, occasionally you see people, right? But it was a very, very long time until I got out, or since I got out. And then one day, my son was getting older, and he just wasn't into books. Like, books were not appealing to him as a small child. So the prospect of getting him to read was very difficult. He just didn't really seem to want to, or have the attention span for it, or, you know, just wasn't really interested. So he and I started to pick up, like, obviously it was around this time that Yu-Gi-Oh! The cartoon show had come out.
Yeah.
And so he really enjoyed that, and we both did, you know, because I'm still a big kid when it comes to television and cartoons. Like, I will 100%, my daughter and I sit every Saturday morning and we watch the new episodes of Dragon Ball Z Kai, and we sit together and we sing the opening song together, and it's awesome. So yeah, family's really big, right? But I'm like raising the next generation of geeks.
That's great. I love that.
Absolutely. So he was really into the show, and I noticed that there was actually a card game, and so I, you know, started to do a little bit of investigation into it and understand it. And of course my brother and I, you know, it was like something for us to do, and I'm like, hey, look, there's this card game, like, do you want to try it out? Let's look at it. I bought a couple starters, you gotta play this, whatever. And so my son would watch, Alex would watch us play, and he was like 4 or 5, whatever. And so he picked up very quickly how to play the game. Mm-hmm. But he still wasn't reading the cards. But he would know that this card can attack, and he would, you know, I mean, he's still young. Mm-hmm. And so he'd want to play, and so we looked at him, and we're like, well, okay. So we tried to teach him to play to try to encourage him to read the cards. All it did was make him really good at subtracting thousands. Mm-hmm. And still just was stubborn with the reading. And so then we decided to pick up Magic again, because it was like Yu-Gi-Oh! Was the gateway drug back into Magic. And so this would have been like, at this point in time, he was reading, but still very badly. Mm-hmm. And not really doing it of his own volition. And so then Magic came out and came back into his life. And he's like, can we play? And we said, look, Alex, this is way more complicated than Yu-Gi-Oh! I said, like, I can't take the time. There's so many different abilities and so many different things. I can't take the time to explain it to you. You're going to have to learn to read. Mm. And he looks at me and he goes, okay. And he goes to his toy box. He pulls out a book. And he sits down and starts reading.
Wow.
Right? So Magic taught my son to read.
Mm.
So would I still be playing Magic? I probably would not have been.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So that's really wild, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, let's just say, you know, God forbid something terrible happens to my family tomorrow and all of a sudden I lose them all and it's just me all alone as a bachelor again. I would probably do nothing but like work, stay up all night, mono grind moto, and make a run of the Pro Tour. Like, mm-hmm. that would be a thing. Just because it would be something to do. It's a community that I love to be a part of. But yeah, that's how it would change.
Do you two still play together, you and your son?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you see getting your daughter into it too?
She already shuffles cards almost as fast as Kibler does.
Really?
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
How does your wife feel about you playing Magic? Did she ever learn how to play?
She has no interest in playing.
Okay.
She has no interest in learning. She's the stone nut at opening packs though.
Wow.
And she loves it. So I just like, The last couple times I've got boxes, that was a long time ago. But I mean, just this weekend, I had a bunch of people over and we were playing cards. And one guy comes in and he's like, boom. We're like, what's this? He opens up this box and it's a case of Theros. And he's like, get opening. And so my wife was there, and he's like, "Here, Lana." She's like, "Oh, that's great." So she opened like 2.5 boxes of Theros, and he made out like a fucking bandit. So, yeah. But no, she supports it. And I mean, you know, it's great that I've been able to turn this hobby and this thing that I love into, like, she saw what it did for my son, mm-hmm. right? She saw what it did for our relationship. And so she could never, you know, never be against it. But, you know, all things require balance.
The most powerful moment in the history of my show comes from Abe Sargent. I knew that I wanted to have Abe on because he is a beloved writer in the community and because he's extremely open about his battle with Huntington's disease and how it affects his life. I was in no way prepared for what Abe would have to say on the topic, and I'm sure my listeners were just as affected by his words as I was.
So, one of the things that really attracted me to your post, Abe, was a post that you wrote in 2012. And this was actually a follow-up piece to one you wrote in 2004. And at the time, there were people that said it was the best piece of magic writing they'd ever written. And it was very, very personal, and it was very unlike anything anybody else had ever read before. What did it feel like to receive that much praise from people about something you wrote, especially something so personal?
It was really humbling. Because when I first wrote Revelations of a Magic Writer, and for those of you in your audience who are not familiar with it, it's an article I wrote some time ago, actually. I think it was in 2004, 2005.
Yeah, 2004.
And I document basically my history as somebody who has a condition called Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease, for those of you who may not be aware, is a genetic disease that I got from my mother. And it's very similar to Parkinson's disease. It's a neurological condition. It's not one that has any sort of a cure, and it causes physical palsies. My body will start to shake and tremor and twitch, and it also causes some changes to my personality and to my mental facilities. And so I wrote an article about being a magic player with that as my end game, because it hadn't started yet. It was called Revelations of a Magic Writer, and it was very well received at the time, and a lot of people, you know, said some really humbling, heartwarming things, and then it kind of had a renaissance about 4 or 5 years afterwards, because Ted Knutson, as part of an interview with Mark Rosewater for Star City Games, just asked him what his favorite Magic article was. And he said his favorite Magic article was Revelations of a Magic Writer, which was written by me. And that was something to hear Mark Rosewater say that my article was his favorite article. And he talks about how it impacted him, because he became much more personal in his articles after reading that. Of course, because this is in a major interview by a major guy, lots of people clicked on the link and read the article again. And a new wave of people really started to push it on Twitter and Facebook. And for that week or two, people like Pat Chapin and stuff are emailing me and Twittering very, very positive things about me. So kind of had that second wave. Then after I was diagnosed with Huntington's disease that had already started, I knew that I was going to write a follow-up piece to let people know what was happening with my life, because it was such an important part of many people's lives. They really got something from it. So I knew I was going to write a follow-up, and I just was waiting for the right way to write that follow-up. Mm-hmm. And when I did, I came up with the concept of On That Day Like Any Other, which is the follow-up to that, which was published, I think, a year ago, and last year on Star City Games 2. Where I talk about what it's like to have been about a year now with Huntington's disease, what that's been like. It was unfortunately earlier than it was supposed to have been, so I kind of got blindsided by it, and it was not what I expected it to be. I expected a physical battle on a regular basis with my body, and it just really has not become that yet. Instead, it's really more mental, and I had not expected that, and so I was kind of surprised by that. And so I had articles about that too, another third wave of people going back and reading the first article to read that one, and another wave of support from some of the same people, as well as a new group of people reading those articles and really, you know, really, really finding something in it that resonated with them. And so being able to touch people with some stories in my life, I think, is part of the value that I think I've added to magic writing generally. Some stuff that I like to continue to do. I like to continue to bring out some occasional personal stories to make Magic about more than just the cards, because we're a community that's bound by a lot more than just, you know, 60 cards in a deck. We're a community that's tied together very strongly. And so I've tried to really push that in my articles, that concept.
Was there a part of you that worried that it was going to be too personal for you? Because this is, from what I gather from reading the articles, this could get ugly.
It could, and
to share a part of yourself with that is huge. And you know, was it a little too raw? Like, were you sure? You know, while you were writing, it was ever a part of you that was like just feeling really exposed, or you know, did you realize how big of a deal it was that you were sharing this at the time?
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize how big of a deal it was going to be. But when I first wrote it, I actually wrote it cathartically, and I wasn't sure if I was ever going to publish it. And then as I read it, I realized that there was something really, really important here, and then I went ahead and published it. And this was right after another Magic writer at that time for Star City Games, I believe his name is Richie Prophet, had just come out with a major medical condition, and which he would die from, I think, a year later. I think they still have an annual memorial tournament for him down in Roanoke. That was kind of an inspiration, too. That he could talk about this in one of his columns, and some people could talk about it, and so I felt that it was important for me to share my story too. Now there were some people that were a little, they weren't sure how to take the article. They read it, but they were like, this is a Magic website. Why are we reading an article about this? And then I also had some feedback from people who didn't fully. I think it's partly my fault for not feeling to communicate with them, but didn't fully understand where I was coming from for some of the things. For example, I mentioned in there that I just never saw myself as getting married, because I wouldn't want somebody I loved to be burdened by having to take care of me for 10 years because of Huntington's disease. So I'm still single to this day. I have no intention of getting married at
Which
all.
Which is a shame, like, because you're adorable.
I appreciate you saying so. But that's just not really been a part of who I am, what my future is going to be like. I'm the last person in my family with Huntington's disease. My mother had it, her father, a few uncles had it, and so forth, but none of them had children. So I'm the last person with this strain of Huntington's disease, and it will die with me. And I'm very comforted by that fact, that beast that slayed my mother will die with me.
Wow, that's such a hefty statement. Like, I can't even tell you what I'm going to have for lunch tomorrow. But, you know, to have that foresight and that determination to say this stops here, and to have that part of your life already mapped out, like, I can't even imagine what that takes. Like, that's wild to me.
Sometimes my guests know what they are in for when they come on the show, and others don't quite clue in until the last minute, like my friend Patrick Chapin.
Well, Patrick, it has certainly been a joy having you on, and I really do appreciate you bearing with me through this and helping me out with this. And it's been great getting to know you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. You'll have to have me back sometime.
I would love to. I mean, my goodness, how can I say no to Patrick Chapin?
But there's a catch.
Uh-oh.
The next time I come back, we got to film this in person, or not necessarily film it, but just record in person. We're in the same room.
Okay.
And there has to be an incredible amount of, like, see, I don't think any podcast has ever done this before, but I'm picturing Jell-O wrestling. We need people to be Jell-O wrestling while we're recording, and so we can just watch the Jell-O wrestling take place.
I'm pretty sure I could get some of my listeners to do it. I'm a pretty wild girl, Patrick, so it wouldn't be hard for me to arrange.
If you set it up. You set it up. I'm going to be at tons of GPs this year. You know? And PTs, it sounds like now they're open. I don't know how much Jell-O you can bring to a PT, but there's what GPs are close to wherever what GPs are close to you?
Well, I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I'll admit that I'm out of vacation time for the rest of 2013, so I'm kind of grounded in terms of 2013. But with 2014, my company just recently announced that they're giving us an extra week of vacation, so I'll have 3 weeks of vacation. And I planned on hitting the GPs hard. I will be a GP Philly next year. I'll be a GP Chicago next year. There's been talk
of those standard.
Yes, those are G.P. Philly is sealed. It's Born of the Gods sealed. Chicago is standard. G.P. Nashville is team sealed. That's in October of next year. I'll be going to that because I love team sealed. There's been talk of me going out to G.P. or Portland for the other team sealed. So I plan on getting my travel on next year.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know for sure which sealed ones I'm going to be at or not. Okay. In the words of Brian Kibler, I don't go to limited GPs anymore. But I will definitely be at the standard ones. Okay. So if you want to set it up for Chicago, if you can find us some Jello wrestlers. it can't just be the same two people. They're going to get tired because we need Jello wrestling continuously. When the Jello wrestling stops, the podcast is over. Dropping the mic, walking out.
Okay, you've got yourself a deal. And if anyone else is listening to the show and you've enjoyed what you've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on legitmtg.com. You can subscribe and listen to the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Feel free to leave me a review and some stars. The show is also on Twitter at the Deck Tees. I am on Twitter at Original Estrus, OriginalOestrus. And you can email me directly at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves.
Wait, okay? Is this an innuendo?
What is?
I just realized, wait, the Deck Tees. What kind of a show is this?
A fun show and an interview-style show and a professional show and an enjoyable show.
Yeah, but there isn't any video.
No. I said you could turn your cam on, but I did not.
I don't want to be the tease.
You've given me so much, though. I can't accuse you of being a tease.
All right, well, we'll have to get some video or something for the Jello wrestling segment.
Yeah, I mean, you can't not. I mean, you can't just have audio Jello wrestling.
Yeah, that would be a little weird.
I mean, they would just hear, like, slapping and grunts and messiness and, yeah.
When I invited Jack LaCroix from Monday Night Magic onto the show, I knew that he was going to be opening up about his battle with alcoholism for the first time to such a wide audience. I was proud of Jack for being so honest and for opening up so much since his appearance on the show. He's gone on to talk about this on other shows and has really let people in more than he ever has before.
So you were once known for being a heavy drinker on a lot of the shows that you appeared on, and you recently stopped. What made you decide to do that?
I would love to say it was just my wife and my daughter, but they were honestly just a small factor to it. They got me to where I was away from the booze a lot, which helped. But what really broke me of it was I had been drinking pretty heavily since I was about 16, which is a very young age to start drinking, I'm aware. But in my county especially, there's nothing here. So you do like some kind of drug or drink. And you have some hobby that you do, and that's how you break in with your social circles. And being the extremely awkward nerd that I was, I played Magic and drank whiskey, and that was my thing. So I just kept drinking and kept drinking, and especially when I moved out on my own, you know, booze was much more readily available then. I didn't have to, like, lie and come in with this backpack that was clanging into my parents' house and things like that. And so I got to where I was drinking about a gallon of whiskey every 2 days. Mm. And at that point, I was so much of an alcoholic that I knew how to hide it very well. Yeah. And I knew how to act like I was functioning completely fine. And I'm in a small town, but my nearest neighbor is 30 minutes away. Mm-hmm. So I could just come home to an empty house and drink and drink and drink and drink and drink. And especially when you're isolated like that, which wasn't very healthy for me, but I did it because I had some innate need to be by myself. It does a lot of things to you. And I got to where I was drinking so much that I don't want to say I was hallucinating, but I was waking up with night terrors and shit like that. And I was drinking to take care of the night terrors. And I would eventually get to where I was so drunk, I would just pass out until the next day and then get up and, you know, quickly shave and throw some deodorant on and make it look like I was clean and put on a fake smile and go out into the world and do my job. And that's a very self-destructive habit. But it was something that I started doing because I'm a very compulsive person. And it just got to a point where a lot of crazy shit started happening because I was drinking. I don't know if you've ever watched the comedian Dave Attell.
No, I haven't, but I do know who he is.
Okay. Dave Attell once talked about alcoholism as time traveling. And it's a perfect description of it because there were whole weeks in my life where I would wake up and I'd have a bottle in my hand and, you know, my friends would be on the couch playing Xbox or something, and I'd take a swig of whiskey and I'd pass back out, and then I would wake up and I would be at the local diner sitting there trying to write a book, and I'd pass out and wake back up and I would be in my house completely naked, sweating. Like, that's just things that are horrible to both wake up to and experience. And then there were things that happened that I've actually never really told anybody, which being the lady who can cough up secrets, I will actually tell this story.
Oh, my.
Yeah. There was one time when I was about 20 and I woke up and I was in a bed and I thought it was my bed. And then I noticed the sheets were pink. And I was like, my sheets aren't pink. Wait a minute. I don't even have sheets on my bed. And so I rolled over and there was a girl. And I didn't know who this girl was. And that was a very scary thing to wake up to. So I very quietly get out of this bed and I find my clothes and I put my clothes on and I walk out of this girl's house and I start patting myself down. I don't have my wallet. I don't have my keys, but I have my phone. Thank God. But I don't have any bars. So I had to walk 5 miles down the road to even get a signal.
Wow.
And I called, and I called my friend up and I was just like, dude, I don't know where the fuck I'm at. I was woke up in somebody's house. Like, can you figure out where I'm at? And he was like, yeah, you know, like, we'll come get you, dude. Just like find a roadside or something. So I had to walk another 5 miles and I finally stopped at this truck stop where naturally they had no phone signal whatsoever. But they had a payphone, as antiquated as that was. So I called my friend up and told him where I was, and he came and got me. And somehow, some way, I had wound up in South Carolina. And I don't even know how that happened.
Wow.
I don't know, like, who that girl was or what happened when I was at her house. I hope it was nothing too nefarious for obvious reasons. But I just somehow got to South Carolina, and I give my friend credit. He didn't, you know, came by, he didn't say anything. He just picked me up and he got me back to my house. And he was like, dude, you really need to never do that again. And I was like, I know. Oh God, drinking's horrible. It's the devil. So as soon as he left, I drank.
Oh,
and and it was just this very self-destructive pattern where I'm really surprised I didn't die of alcohol poisoning. And there were a lot of other contributing factors to it. I mean, I went through deep black depression where I thought about killing myself all the time and things like that. And then eventually my wife came back to our hometown and she started coming by to see me because we've been in love since we were in middle school. Mm-hmm. I just was never mature enough to fully appreciate her until I got older. And she started coming by, you know, just to check up on me. And then one day she kind of noticed all the booze and she noticed all the empty bottles in the trash and stuff like that. And she noticed there was no food in my fridge. But there was booze. There was always booze.
Yeah.
And so she started coming by and just checking up on me regularly and making sure I was okay and coming by and bringing me food and things like that. And then there was one day I woke up and I just had a horrible, like, pounding jackhammer of a headache. And it was another night I was completely naked and had been the dead of winter. And she was at the stove fixing food and I got up and I just was moaning and groaning and in pain. And she came over and fed me like a kid. And that was very emasculating, but it was a very caring, kind, considerate gesture. And after I eventually woke up, she was like, so I called you last night and you didn't answer. And I came over here to make sure you were okay. And you were outside vomiting. So you're going to stop drinking now.
Wow.
And I was just like, okay. And she's like, and I'm going to take all the booze in the house and I'm going to throw it away. And I was like, no, don't do that. And when I said that, like, that came out of my mouth and I realized I cared that much about the booze. That was a big fucking deal.
Was that your bottom?
I wouldn't say that was my bottom. My bottom was actually when I was drunk and I had to drive to the birth of my daughter.
Oh.
It got to where I was really bad. And,
Even after waking up in another state in a bed you don't know, even after you're having your now wife feed you and tell you she's going to do these things, you still went back to drinking after these two times?
Yeah, and wow. The thing is, as you know, you talked about being addicted to soda, but when you're really addicted to something, you don't really acknowledge that you have a serious problem. And it's like I was saying a moment ago, I'm an extremely compulsive person. If there's like cake around me, I'm going to eat the cake just because it's there. And there was just always booze in the house, and there was always money in my pocket if there wasn't booze, and I could go get the booze. And honestly, when Riley was born, I was sitting on the couch and I'd had a couple of beers and I'd already significantly cut back on my drinking. I stopped drinking as whiskey nearly as much and I'd cut back to drinking beer, and I fucking hate beer so much. So that had a lot to do with it, cutting back on the drinking as well. But my wife called me and she was like, "Oh, hey, baby, you know, my water broke. And I'm at the mall, so I'm going to go do a couple of go to a couple of shops. And, you know, then I'm going to go on to the hospital." And even as drunk as I was like, "Holy shit, like, no, you need to go to the hospital right fucking now." She was like, "No, you know, like, I'm just going to go for a walk and see how things go. And that'll be good, right?" And I hate to say this, how pregnant women are hormonal. She didn't really realize what she was saying. So it was like, "No, I'm going to come over there right now and I'm going to pick you up and we're going to go to the hospital." And I hung the phone up and I sat there and I was like, "Dude, you're drunker than shit and you have to drive your wife who's going into labor to the hospital. You have to do this though." And I was like, "All right, time to act like I'm as sober as possible." So I got in my car and I managed to get us to the hospital and everything okay. And we got through the birth and it was totally terrifying. Like, regardless of what other people tell you about children being born, it's terrifying. Yeah. And so we got through all that and I got to hold Riley and I was sitting there and I was like, "Wow, I really need to never fuck up ever again because she deserves better than this." Mm-hmm. And that's what turned things around for me, was seeing Riley look up at me. She's just this little bundle in a pink blanket with a little tuft of head on her head, tuft of hair on her head. And she looked up at me and just a little tear rolled down her cheek. And that completely turned everything around.
Mm-hmm. I found your Tumblr post about this. It's called "Man in a Bottle." And you acknowledge the fact that you're not cured either. And you use quotations around the word cured. And you mentioned about the fact, "Every day I wake up wanting a drink." Is that still true?
Yeah. And there's still times when I'm sitting there and we'll eat corn or something. And I remember corn liquor I had, 4 or 5 years ago. 'Cause that's what people do around here. We make meth and moonshine and go hunting. And that's all we really do. And I'll remember that and I'll just sit there and I'm like, "Man, some corn liquor would be so good right now." But I have to remember the person I was and the path I was on and things like that. And that really turns it around. And I'm not going to lie, I've gone out with friends a couple of times, and over the last 4 months, I've been almost completely sober. But I'd go out one night with my friends, and I had a beer, and that was it. And then, you know, a month or two later, I would have one beer with people that I wouldn't even finish. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I definitely wake up wanting to drink, and I definitely go to bed thinking alcohol would be a great way to fall asleep. But I've come to realize and accept that there's no way I'm ever going to go back to what I was doing, because if I did, it would not only kill me, it would kill my family.
Yeah. You also said something else at the end of that post that really stood out to me. You said, "I felt I had to get it out because only recently have I come to terms with the fact I was a coward about drinking the entire time." Do you feel braver since you made that confession on your Tumblr?
Oh, no, I was still absolutely a coward about drinking, and I'm still a coward about drinking. Even sitting here talking to you about how much I drank and things like that, I've never told people those stories. And, you know, had I done that, maybe somebody out there would have been like, "Dude, you need help." Mm-hmm. You know, call me, talk to me. And especially since I have been more open, Angelo Paglucci, the guy who does Pit Imps, Angelo's been really good about talking to me about drinking and addiction and things like that. But it's one of those things where I had to work through it myself and talk to people about it. And I'd be willing to open up about it, because I'm very secretive. I'm very secluded about how I handle things. And that's not a good way to go through life.
Yeah.
You have to open up to people. You have to open up to your friends and accept them. And that's really what becoming a father, and especially being in this community, has taught me, is it's okay to love other people. Even if you don't love yourself, they can help you get to that point where life does get better, and they do love you and they do care about you. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to love them back for who they are.
If you've been listening to the Dectees for a while, or if you've been following me on Twitter, you know that I'm a huge fan of Reed Duke. I like to refer to him as the light of my life and the fire of my loins. So it was a big deal for me to get him on the show. He was every bit as humble and as sweet as I thought he would be, and he even showed he could laugh at himself a little too. So the last thing I want to ask you about, since you brought up style, Reed, I don't know if you're aware of this, but your hair is about as popular as you are. Did you know this?
Yeah, I mean, I would have said more popular.
It has its own Twitter account, Reed Duke's Hair.
Right.
Your hair is following me. I just want you to know that.
Okay.
What's the secret to the hair? Were you always blessed with these luscious locks, or what's going on there?
I mean, it's just simple stuff, really. I mean, it's getting cold out where I live this time of year, so whenever I go out, I wrap each individual strand of hair in a silk bag to make sure that I don't get split ends or anything like that. But I mean, it's just basic stuff. Other than that, pretty much just washing it twice a day with mermaid tears. And, yeah, you know, just stuff that everybody does.
Nice. And it's funny because I know people will. That's something I see a lot on the stream, too. Like, I remember I was watching one of your streams once and I was at home. I was home for something. I don't remember what. And my mom walked past the screen and she was like, look at that little boy playing in the magic event. And I was like, that's Reed Duke. And he's like 20 something. And I think you had just got a haircut and it made you look really, really young. And my mother was asking, you know, what is that young man doing there? Is he old enough? And I'm like, he's old enough. I was like, oh, this is awkward. And
yeah, that's funny. I do get that a lot when I cut my hair.
Yeah. But do you ever find it sort of like a Samson and Delilah, where like when the hair is long, you perform better? Or if you cut the hair, suddenly you don't perform as well? Is that a thing?
Sometimes. I think it's good to dramatically change your appearance every once in a while and just kind of like, you know, be a new person and put your best foot forward and just, you know, almost like a New Year's resolution. But it's like, all right, I'm going to cut my hair. And that's it. I'm not going to lose anymore. You know, that's going to be the change that I need to really get things going.
You should just freak people out and show up bald one day. Just shave it all off.
That's something that might happen.
One of the reasons that I blogged for many years, and now one of the reasons that I do a podcast, is to feel relatable and to find people that I can relate to. Marshall Sutcliffe was one of those people that I really related to, and even more so after he came on the show. I made a comment about how I wasn't sure my show was big enough to warrant having its own merchandise or Kickstarter, and he definitely made me think otherwise with what he had to say about the subject.
It's definitely given me something to think about. I think you were even tagged in a tweet. There's something going around called Patreo or Patruno.
It's called Patreon.
Patreon.
With an N.
Okay. Yeah. And somebody had asked me the other day why I'm not on it. And I was just like, who'd want to give to my little dog and pony show? Like, what are you talking about? And I've had people say to me, you know, why don't you have t-shirts? Why don't you, there are things that these other shows are doing that you should be doing. And it's not that I don't want to, but again, I don't know my subscribers. I don't know my downloads. I still think of myself as the girl nobody listens to. And it's very strange to me when people give me these suggestions that shows like yours have done. So it's like, I am not you. Like, I cannot, there's nobody who would give me any money. There's nobody who would buy a t-shirt of mine, and it's definitely given me something to think about, where I'm starting to consider these things. It's like, could I? Should I?
I think you should. I really do think that you should keep it in your mind. I mean, I think that like the basic progress of these things is like, you're a new show. Nobody knows who the hell you are. Mm-hmm. And then you start building an audience. Maybe you catch a break here or there. Somebody, you know, mentions, oh, I listen to this podcast, and then you pick up a few listeners here, and then somebody retweets something, you pick up a few listeners there, and then word of mouth starts taking over, and now, you know, you start to build up an audience. And then, you know, you seem to have really hit your stride with your show. I mean, I think your show started off a little different, right? Like,
yeah.
It wasn't, you know, interview podcast, but now it's kind of, that's kind of where you're at.
Yep.
Yeah. And you know, that's important. Like, you've made, like, I really feel like, you know, for your show, you've hit your stride about, this is what this show is about, right? And like you said, you've gotten some really, really big names, which is fantastic. And I think it's just a matter of like, build your audience, get an idea for what's going on with that. And then, yeah, I think like, I defy anybody to tell me why you shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. Like, you earned this. You've put, like, people don't understand how many hours and it's not even just the hours that it takes to make a successful show. It's showing up consistently.
Yeah.
I mean, do you know how many times, I'm not asking you, this is more rhetorical because you do know how many times I've had people say, hey, we're drafting tonight. Do you want to come over? We need an eighth or we need a sixth or whatever.
I have to record my show.
Got to do the podcast, mm-hmm. Right? Or, you know, somebody's dinner is tonight and it's their birthday and I'll be late, you know, or I'm not going to be able to make it. Right. And like, you gotta, and it's like every week, and I've been sick and I've had bad stuff and good stuff. And I'm just like, I got to do the show, you know, and not felt like doing the show, did the show. Right. And so it's like, you know, I personally believe that like, you've put a lot of effort into your show. I put a lot into my show, and I see no reason why, if there's a willing audience, you shouldn't benefit from that financially or any other way. Mm-hmm. Just, I don't think that people see that, you know, I don't think that people see the work that goes into make something good, and the thought process and the worry, and it becomes your baby at some point. And, you know, now it's like you have to protect your baby, and, you know, there's just a whole lot of effort that goes in. And like I said, I just think it's great that, you know, there's another site called Subbable. PayPal just does the subscription things too. I mean, you have a lot of options, and I just think it's a beautiful world where you can get somebody who wants something and somebody who can provide it, and they can get together and be happy.
Last but not least on this list of greatest hits is Tifa Robles, formerly Tifa Mayan. See? Never fails. This clip was taken from her second appearance on the show after she quit her job at Wizards, and I was immediately struck by how she described her split from them almost as if she were going through a breakup. Like, if you closed your eyes and you didn't know that she was talking about a job, you would think she had just gotten out of a relationship. And I know that there are times in my life where I viewed my career as a relationship, so I really related to what she said and her honesty about the whole thing.
So in December, you decided to quit your job at Wizards. And
I did.
You told me a little bit about what led up to that. Give me some more insight into that. Like, what made you decide to pull the plug?
So the way that I really like to explain this, like the easiest way to explain this to people, is to view it like scales. Mm-hmm. Where when I first started at Wizards, the scale was tipped in the favor of working there very strongly. Mm-hmm. It was clearly the best career move for me to be a brand manager. LPS was pretty small at the time. I wasn't really known or anything like that. Like, I didn't have a lot of opportunities. So working at Wizards was like huge, and I was super, super happy there. I loved the people. I loved my manager. It was just this great place. Perfect, like, start for just out of college career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was willing to put all of my other things, like my novel writing, which you can't really do while working at Wizards, and all these other things that, like, you know, I had interest in acting and interest in conventions, but like, none of that was big enough for me to not take this career. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, I'll put all these things on the back burner for now and just really focus on being a brand manager for Magic. Over the course of time, I was at Wizards for 3 years. I was a brand manager for 2. And over the course of those 2 years that I was a brand manager, the scales slowly tipped in the other direction over time. Mm-hmm. As Lady Planeswalkers got bigger and bigger and got more exposure, and more people were asking me to be on interviews and, like, to be on their vlogs and all these other things, you know, that was becoming harder and harder to not only turn down, because sometimes I was allowed to do things, but, like, the larger they got, the less likely they were going to let me do them. Mm. So, like, when really big names were coming to me and I would ask for permission, they were like, no. And they got to the point where they were like, LPS has gotten too much, like, too big for you to be both that and a brand manager. And they actually gave me the ultimatum of, like, what are you going to focus on? Because right now you're two personas, and they felt that those two personas were clashing. Mm. And it took me a couple months of, like, thinking about that for me to make the decision. But with all of that happening, I was less happy at work. To be honest, I wasn't really feeling appreciated. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, there were all these opportunities that they, like, I had to turn down. Mm-hmm. And I ended up missing out on some of them, unfortunately. And, like, I'm hoping that in the future they'll come back. And, like, I knew that I had other job prospects. Even just, like, mentioning the idea of finding another job, I had tons of friends that were like, oh, you would totally fit in here. So I knew that, like, that wouldn't be a problem. But more importantly than that, all those personal goals that I'd pushed back in the back burner were, like, coming up. Uh-huh. I got, like, very, very frustrated that I hadn't written in so long, that I used to draw even, and like I never intended to like be an artist, but just the fact that like I never did any of that like creative stuff that I used to do, and I wasn't even allowed to while working there, it got very frustrating, and I was having all these like personal conflicts within myself of like, what is important to me? Why am I letting this corporation like kill that person? Mm-hmm. Like I felt like I'd lost a big part of myself. So, you know, obviously the scales had flipped. I didn't think my career was really moving at the pace that I wanted it to. And it was obvious that it wasn't going to be anytime soon. So I decided to quit. Mm-hmm. And like, it was not an easy decision. Magic means so much to me. And I was so scared that like, once I left Wizards that, you know, half of the people that followed me would suddenly think that I didn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. Like that was a huge fear of mine. And I actually know of a few people that that did happen with. Every time I've had friends, people I thought were friends from Wizards, like unfollow me and defriend me. And that was really painful. And like other people in the Magic community that I have a lot of respect for that stopped following me. And it was, you know, I expected it. Luckily it didn't hit me as hard as I thought it might. Like I thought it might be a much larger mm-hmm. percent, but I had a lot of people in the Magic community that were excited for me.
Yeah.
Tons of people that were like, congratulations, I'm proud of you. Like overwhelmingly so. And I did not expect that at all. And that was really wonderful, and encouraging. And it felt very empowering to make that decision and, you know, proudly tell the public instead of it being like, wow, you made a huge mistake, mm-hmm. Which is kind of what I expected. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful decision. Like I'm so much happier now. Just each day I just feel this freedom. I explained the feeling before. I love this analogy where if you're somebody who needs glasses, before you have glasses, you think you can see. Mm-hmm. Like you think you know what the world looks like. And, you know, you're like, oh, I don't really need glasses. And then you go and you get glasses. You're like, fine, I'll wear these stupid things. And then you can suddenly, like, see, like, detail. And it's like everything is slightly different. That's how it felt. Like, I felt like I went from, like, having these shackles that I didn't realize were that heavy. But then as soon as I left, this, like, overwhelming freedom of, like, I can do whatever I want. I could say whatever I want. And I don't have to be afraid. Uh-huh. And it was just really wonderful that, you know, on top of that, I had all this support from these people that I have respect for.
So there we have it. Those were my 10 favorite moments from my time doing the Deck Tees. But this list is not definitive. There are a lot of moments that I'm extremely proud of and that I don't think you will hear anywhere else. So I encourage you to go through my previous episodes, which you can find on Gathering Magic or iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and listen to them for yourself. If you would like to follow the show on Twitter, you can do so at the Deck Tees. If you would like to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at Original Estrus, OriginalOestrus, or you can email me personally at Estrus, Oestrus, at elitistjerks.com. Thank you all so much for listening and through sticking with me all this time, and take care of yourselves, okay?